Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Mike McCormack. On his latest novel, This Plague of Souls.
Mike McCormack is an award-winning novelist and short story writer from Mayo Island. His previous works include Getting It in the Head, Notes from a Coma, which was shortlisted for the BGE Irish Novel of the Year, and Forensic Songs. In 1996, he was awarded the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature for Getting It in the Head. In 2016, his novel Solar Bones won the Goldsmiths Prize and was the BGE Irish Book of the Year, was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2017 and won the International Dublin Literary Award in 2018. And today we're here to talk about Mike's latest novel, which is This Plague of Souls. Mike, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great to be here.
So I ask every novelist I interview this first question, and I'm especially excited for this novel. Please, would you tell me, Mike, how you would describe this novel?
Okay. I would describe it, when I try to conceive of it in my head, I described it as a piece of metaphysical noir. So obviously, the book seems to me to be written under the star of those French existential thrillers that I've loved, people like Philippe Dard, I think it is, and Pascal Garnier, latterly, and Simenon. All of those writers who managed to deliver short, sharp, snappy, dark novels in less than 200 pages, those noir novels in which there was great existential issues in it. They weren't like their American counterparts where issues were resolved with gunplay and violence and that. It seemed to me that ideas were the dangerous things in these books, and life itself was a dangerous proposition. So when I was sitting down to do it, I think I've loved the clippedness and the darkness of European noir. But I've always had this thing in my head, can I yoke disparate things together? I think, well, let's make it a metaphysical noir. And what would a metaphysical noir be? And then I thought, well, noir is generally about revenge, reward, all of that, whether it be a Maltese Falcon or whether it be, you know, beautiful women or something like that, or the love of a beautiful woman or something like that. But in this, I wanted reality, I think, itself to be the issue. I wanted the things that we know. What are the things we know and what are the things we can put our faith in? So to go back to the beginning of your question, I think I conceived of it as a piece of metaphysical noir. One of those sharp, dark little books that came up on you quickly, delivered a whack on the ear and left you with a black stain on your soul, a black watermark on your soul. That was my conception.
Well, I was excited to ask you the question because I read in a different interview with you that you mentioned that you wanted to write a book that you couldn't explain.
Well, that was the other part, yeah. I wanted to, a book where I'd have to throw up my hands at the end and go, there's so much I know about this, but there is an awful lot of questions that I cannot answer. The central character, Neelan, he meets this man who puts it to him that he is responsible for a certain number of things, for this construct, this artistic metaphysical construct that's out there, which seems to be nothing less than a reshaping of the world in some way or other. And he asks him, is he responsible for it? And Neelan says, I can't help you. And now the question comes back to the author, me, do I know? And I don't know whether he's responsible for it or not. I couldn't tell you whether he's responsible for it or not. There are other questions in the book, and I don't know if he's, I don't know how those resolve either. And but I have to be careful talking about this because in some ways that doesn't sound a very attractive proposition to the reader. But I would hope that the book is, I would hope that the book leaves you with questions, but that what's between the covers of the book is very clear. And it seems to me put very clearly, it's about two men who go in search of two different things and who arrive at a hotel in the west of Ireland. One of them goes in search of his wife and child, and the other, it seems to me, goes in search of God. And they have this conversation. And as a time came in the composition of the book when my cup of cluelessness overflowed, and I knew then that the book was complete.
Well, we also, there's lots of answers in the book as to, well, Neelan, the character, the protagonist, we'll talk about him in a moment, but his character is sort of fleshed out over the course of the novel. We find out things, or do we, about, you know, what he may or may not have done. And so there is lots of stuff that we won't give away about the novel for the reader to discover for themselves. This is, on the one hand, it feels like a very different book to Solar Bones, which famously was composed of one long sentence, but it also seems to have a kinship as well. So are the two novels related in your mind?
I think they are, and I think they can be read separately as well, with no loss. You're right. It's a very different book aesthetically and as a narrative construct. Solar Bones, as you said, was a single riverine outpour uninterrupted. And it was a sunlit book. And this one, this Plague of Souls, it's a darker, more nocturnal proposition. And it's also written in the rhythms of noir, short, sharp, clipped rhythms and that. When I had finished Solar Bones, I was very struck by the what I thought I saw. It was only when it was done, really, that I thought I saw what it was about. And this is about, it was about men making the world. And because Solar Bones is a book about an engineer, it's about a man who quite literally does make the world. And he makes it in roads and bridges and all those civil engineering projects that define our world and which we hold to be so dear. And he, on the other hand, this is the world he's built outside of himself. But he's also successfully built a family. He has a decent marriage. He's a good marriage. It's not without its troubles, but it's a good marriage. And he has two kids whom he loves and wants to be there for. Again, that's not without its difficulties. So it seems that in that book, what I seem to be very interested in is how men build these worlds that are sometimes difficult for them to live in. We know that as an engineer, Marcus Conway found it difficult to live in the world because he had to cope with politicians and commercial interests. And sometimes engineering virtue is squeezed out by those two twin considerations in that. And so when I had finished Solar Bones, I think, geez, I really like that theme of world building, people who build worlds. I wonder, can I have another go at it? And this Plague of Souls suggested itself as okay, there's, how would an artist go about it? How would an artist go about rebuilding the world? I was very taken during COVID, and I don't know if this was the same in your part of the world, but I was very taken during COVID how, particularly during the first lockdown, artists stepped up to make the world a better place. We, you know, my Facebook page, I sat and I watched concerts, free concerts at night. I listened to poetry recitals. I saw theatre being screened live. And I saw all these wonderfully gifted people stepping up to this moment of uncertainty and menace. And I saw them give of their time, their gifts, their inspiration freely. And I was very impressed by that. I was very proud of it as well. This is my, you know, I'm an artist as well. And this was my tribe stepping forward to help alleviate this moment and to make sense of this moment. And then I was thinking, that seemed to provide an ongoing prompt and meditation for this Plague of Souls. I started this book a long time ago, and the first files I have on my computer go back to 2012. But what I noticed back then was that the book seemed to concern itself with how the world falls apart, how the world breaks down, how families break down, how, you know, the health systems and all sorts of other systems break down. But as the composing of the book went along, it became much more interested in how do we put it back together? How do we weld it together and sustain it and hold it together. And I think that that's where all of those meditations, that meditation of world building, brings it into a conversation with Solar Bones. It's a thematic continuation. There's no real narrative, other one or two things recur across the books and that, but say principally, for instance, the locale, both of them start in the same place. Both of them actually, and I never know, would you, it's amazing how clueless you can be about your own work, but I never noticed that the beginning of the two books are identical almost. Solar Bones begins in the middle of the day, and it begins on the Angelus bell. A man returns to his own house and he's bewildered and he doesn't know where he is and that. And that's the sunlit one, Solar Bones. But this Plague of Souls begins in the middle of the night, where a man comes home and it's not the Angelus bell this time. It's the phone, his mobile phone, that goes off in his pocket the moment he crosses the threshold into a house where he is kind of discombobulated and completely at sea for a little while. So yeah, the books are in, I think, in conversation from each other. Well, actually in conversation from each other and in conversation with each other. And also they are a meditation on the same theme of world building. So yeah, there is that linkage between them.
Well, this Plague of Souls also features the Angelus Bell as well as Solar Bones,
right.
But we won't necessarily talk about why is. I was going to ask you about how the book came together in terms of its sort of like, you know, gestation period. What's interesting is to hear you say that it started in 2012. The backdrop of this novel, you mentioned the idea of the world coming apart. The backdrop of this novel is a alluded to but quite vague security incident that's going on, which I think in 2012 would definitely have had much more of a feeling of a terrorist incident. But now, latterly reading the book now, one also can't help but think of, you know, climate catastrophe and inevitably the pandemic as well.
Yeah, you're definitely right in that. It when I would have started the book, it would definitely have been under the big narrative arc. Global narrative arc would have been the war on terror, I think. There was the terrorist attacks over Europe, there was terror attacks in Bali and Thailand. And because we have this, I suppose, recurring suspicious incident where we refuel American planes in Shannon Airport, lots of people have wondered and speculated that it would leave us vulnerable to some sort of terrorist attack. Because there's always been a suspicion that the Shannon Airport, there has sometimes been a suspicion that Shannon Airport might be used as a transit point for the conveying of prisoners to various unmarked locations for enhanced interrogation, as it's called, or torture, as it's properly known. And people have raised this question again and again, and they've also they've pointed out that it makes us complicit in the war on terror, ergo we would be seen as a terrorist target. And you know, I have to say, you know, for my shame, I have to say that when I'm walking around in my daily life, I don't give that type of thing much thought myself. But when I sit down to start and write, that did come to my mind and asserted itself in the writing of the book. And there are pages in the book that seem to be like COVID, that take their shading in light and some other procedural drama from COVID. So that's why, in some sense, I speak of the book as a post-COVID novel from within COVID. I would hope that it would be attractive in that way. I don't know, has a great COVID novel been written yet? Maybe. I don't know.
There's certainly been a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is my partial take on an aspect of it in that, yeah.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Mike McCormack, and we're talking about his new novel, This Plague of Souls. And so, Mike, let's talk about Neelan, who is the protagonist of the novel. And again, I mentioned in the first half that his character is revealed, and what he may have done or may not have done is revealed as we go. So we're obviously not going to give anything that away. But tell us what we know about him, who he is at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah, he returns to a house which within a couple of pages we find out is his own house in that, and we find out through conversations that happen through the book that he's the son of a single father. He lost his mother in what the dates appear to suggest was the Monaghan pub bombings, the Dublin Monaghan bombings of 1974. And he lost his mother in that incident. He was more or less birthed out of that shambles, out of that kind of terrorist attack. And because of that, he has lived alone with his father, a happy, good, decent man. He's lived alone with him. And his father looked after him, cared for him. They got on well together, these two men, and these two father and boy in the one house. No woman ever crossing the threshold after the death of his mother. And they put this world together, and it's the world of a small farmer in the west of Ireland. And he's indistinguishable for every other young boy from his age in that, but except for one thing, that he's quite gifted. He's a gifted artist, particularly gifted with drawing, good with charcoal, good with pen and ink drawing. That seems to be what he will go on to have a reputation for, being the best draftsman of his generation. His father dies quite early in his life, and he rents his farm out. And the next thing then he finds is that we find him in college making his reputation as an artist and that. And we don't know that much about him, except that he does get involved with a very beautiful woman, a woman called Alwyn. And she exerts a fascination and a spell over him. She seems to be wiser and smarter than him. And they have a child together. So that's really the facts of what we know about his life. The rest, it seems to me, is speculation. Is he responsible for the crime? Yes, and he comes back after being on remand. He was accused of a crime that collapsed when it got to trial. And so those are the things we know, but it's the things outside that are really interesting, and that we find beguiling, and which I, as the author, I cannot answer for either. I don't know.
So Alwyn, his wife, she's disappeared, or she is not present in the house when he comes back. We only ever hear about her through his sort of imaginings, through his descriptions. And he sees her as this, like you mentioned, he sees her as, you know, maybe smarter than him. But he also views her in this, like, quite, the way he describes her is sort of quite saintly. He sort of puts her on a pedestal. Tell us a little bit more what you can about her. Again, we have to be careful about what we give away.
Did you find her interesting? You did.
Yeah.
Because I, Yes, I do, because I find her interesting as well. He met her in what seems to be that, as part of that rave culture where there was throbbing beats and rhythms and flashing lights, and she looms out of this thing and she kisses him and she has a tab on her tongue. And the next thing he wakes up with her the next day and he's besotted. He's besotted with her, intrigued by her, and they go and they have a conversation. She tells him, she has this interesting conversation. She tells him what she does. She says, I come and I listen to your story and you tell me about your life. And then I go and it's fed into a think tank and all of a sudden government policy is shifted. So again, she's one of these people that seems to make the world in one way or other, shape the world in one way or other. And the next thing then was that she appears to have she has a drug habit, a really serious drug habit, and he rescues her from that. And and in a scene it's a scene in which he makes his reputation as both a man of action and he carries her west, and she part of it never forgives him for that. He sees it as he's rescuing a princess from a high tower or something like that, and she sees it as an abduction.
Yeah, he kidnaps her, Mike. He kidnaps her.
He kidnaps her. All right, I'll confess to it. He kidnaps her. And then they come home and they have this unmerciful fight, which is, I think, the longest scene in the book in many ways. And it's a fight that goes on for four pages. And it's a fight to exhaustion, not towards injury or towards annihilation. It's a fight towards exhaustion. It's a fight towards cleanliness, in which she and him try to purge her of the toxins in her body. And she goes on to live with him and have a child by him and everything. But then he comes back and he finds her gone. And where has she gone to? And where has she taken his child? He has obviously let her down seriously in some way or other. And now she's gone. And so this man who rings him up in the middle of the night, he seems to hold out the promise that he can answer this question. He can tell him where she is. And that's the lure that brings him on this car journey and a little odyssey towards this hotel where he meets this interlocutor, this man who seems to know an awful lot about Neelam. So that's Alwyn. You're right. She's a pale presence. Pale, I would hope, in not being underwrote, but in pale as in mysterious.
I also thought, I mean, it may be just for the name as well, but although you mentioned, they meet at a rave, in my mind, she was this sort of like saintly figure from some illuminated manuscript, some sort of like, old ancient manuscript, and like just looked like something out of Lord of the Rings or something.
Yeah, and he has a curious meditation on her where he speaks of her, that she's a sacrificial victim in some sort of ancient tableau or something like that. And then he has another vision of her floating on her back in outer space, trailing a load of intravenous lines and catheters and things like that. I don't know what he's trying to get at. I'm not awful sure what he's trying to get at in both of those things, but he certainly sees her visually. She presents a very strong visual presence to him for all her paleness. She presents a very strong visual presence to him, and she has real allure. I have to say I'm quite taken with her myself, and I don't know much more than that about her, but she's very interesting.
We've talked about the two of the main characters, and I've deliberately avoided talking about the man on the phone, although you've mentioned him a couple of times. He's the other sort of this sort of triumvirate of main characters. And the world that Neelam comes back to and then drives through seems in the main quite depopulated. I mean, you mentioned that, this is a metaphorical novel, and as one reads it, one might be lulled into the idea that he is like driving through some sort of like post-apocalyptic scene. But then we do start to get glimpses of other characters. A lot of the chapters will end with like just a little tiny sketch of another character, which we won't talk about why that all comes back towards the end of the novel as to maybe who these people are. But I just wanted to talk about those like incredibly vivid little sketches of people just writing, you're composing of those little sort of sketches of these people, because they're wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I agonized over them. All right. I didn't know. because they represent a kind of a visual shift and a visual shift at the end of those chapters. And the difficulty was in trying to both maintain this is to maintain the rhythm of the chapter in which they were appended to. And I'm glad you found those interesting, because I had agonized about putting them there and leaving them there. And and in the end, I took a gamble on leaving them there. I was by no means certain that they would. That they were right, but I took a gamble, and no one has told me that they're a complete disaster. But you're right, there's four or five of them people. There's one woman who's buying a watch for her son. There's another woman looking through a Boots catalog. There are four or five people, men out in the field digging a trial hole, and there's one or two more that won't come to me at the moment, and they just seem to be it's interesting that you bring those forward it's interesting actually, and I didn't think of this. It's interesting that you speak about this in the context of a denuded and depopulated world through which the book does appear to move by times. It's in fact, he goes to his neighbor's house and there's no one at the neighbor's house, and that, so it's very interesting that I never thought of that, I have to say. But they're people that I'm fond of. They have they are one of a kind of a gallery of people that I think turn towards the final moment of the book.
So to finish it off then, can I get you to read us a bit?
You can, and thank you so much for your time and attention. I really appreciate it. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I'm going to read the first two and a half, 3 pages of the book. Opening the door and crossing the threshold in the dark triggers the phone in Neelan's pocket. He lowers his bag to the floor and looks at the screen. It's not a number he recognises. For the space of one airless heartbeat, he has a sense of things drifting sideways, draining over an edge. The side of his head is bathed in a forensic glow of the screen light. Yes, you're back. Hello. Welcome home, Neelan. Who am I talking to? Oh, only a friend would call at this hour. The voice on the other end is male and downbeat. It's not the sort you would choose to listen to in the dark. Neelan is aware of himself in two minds, the voice on the phone drawing against his immediate instinct to orient himself in the dark hallway. He turns to stand with his back to the wall. You know who I am? Oh, that's the least of what I know. What do you want? 2 paces to his left, Neelan spots a light switch. He reaches out with his spare hand and throws it back and throws it again. Nothing. Half his face remains shrouded in blue light. He takes 5 steps to open a door and passes into what he senses is an open room. A swipe of his hand over a low shadow finds a table, and he draws out a chair and he takes the rest of the phone call, sitting in the dark. I thought I'd give you a shout, the voice says. You have the wrong number. I don't think so. I'm going to hang up. No, there's no rush. Goodbye. We should meet up. No. Not tonight. Not tonight. You're just in the door. You need some rest. We don't have anything to talk about. I would not be so sure. I am. Well, in a day or so, when you're settled. No, not then, not ever. We'll talk again. One last thing. What is it? Don't be sitting there in the dark. The main switch is over the back door. And with that, the phone goes dead in Neelan's hand. Neelan pushes aside his immediate wish to dwell on the phone call. Who's it from? What's it about? He needs to orient himself in the house, so that is what he sets himself to. After a quick scan through his phone, he finds the torch app and he sweeps the room with the light at arm's length. To his right is another small room, barely 6 feet wide, with a fridge and a cooker and shelves along one wall. It's also a solid door over which sits a junction box with a complex array of meters and fuses. The main switch is at the end, but it's too high to reach, so he drags the chair from the table. He steps up and throws the light. Light floods from the hallway with the kitchenette and living room. The table sits beneath a large curtain window, and beyond it is a sink and a worktop with white cupboards overhead. Everything is flat-pack melamine. All the units date from sometime in the 80s. Around the left-hand wall sits a 3-seater couch over which hangs a picture of the Sacred Heart with its orange votive light now glowing beneath. He reaches out and flicks the switch. The walls come up in a cool green glow against which the pine table seems warm and homely. There are 5 doors off the L-shaped hallway. First is a bathroom with a shower cubicle tucked behind the door and a toilet behind the small window which looks out to the back of the house. Behind each of the other doors are 3 bedrooms of equal size with a double bed and built-in wardrobes. Pillows and duvets are stacked on the walls, but all the wardrobes are empty. Back into the hall. There's something coercive in the flow of the house, the way it draws him through it. These are doors that have to be opened, rooms that have to be entered and stood in. He catches himself looking up, examining the ceiling. What does he expect to find up there? Inside the front door is a sitting room where a laminate floor runs to a marble fireplace with a low mantelpiece. To the left and right of the chimney breast, empty bookshelves reach to the ceiling. In the middle of a floor is a single armchair angled towards a large television. Its shape and plain covering making an obvious partner to the couch in the living room. Empty and all as the house is, it still has the residual hum and bustle of a family life. It feels clean and it has been carefully maintained. It's not the raw cleanliness of a last-minute blitz before neighbours arrive, but that ongoing visit effort that keeps it presentable to any sudden need. Neelan becomes aware of a low vibration throughout the room and stands listening for a moment. He lowers his hand to the radiator and finds that the heat has come on. The house is beginning to warm up.
So I've been talking to Mike McCormack, who have been talking about his novel, This Plague of Souls, which is out in the UK now from Canongate. Mike, thanks so much for telling me about it.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.